This is AM 1400 KVFD, the voice of Fort Dodge, and I'm Michael Devine. This is a Divine Intervention, and we are going to tell the truth, make it matter, and never be boring. I know there's a lot of people out there who say they're going to tell you the truth, and I want to modify my earlier remark as to the truth. It's the truth as far as I'm concerned. I'm never going to lie to you. But other people do have a different opinion. Perhaps Dr. Dean Stanzel has a different opinion today, and we're going to find out. How are you, Dr. Stanzel?
I'm doing great. How about yourself, Michael?
I'm real good. Dr. Dean Stanzel, Professor Dean Stanzel, take your pick, doesn't make any difference, is a professor of economics at Florida Gulf Coast University. He's been on our program before, and it's always a delight to talk with Dean Stanzel. And the last time you were on, Dean, I was having, and I know you have worked in the past for the Cato Institute. Now, the Cato Institute is a think tank. Some would say a conservative think tank. I would describe it more as a libertarian think tank. I have been a member of the Cato Institute. I have supported the Cato Institute in whatever small way I could over many years because I admire, because of the intellectual rigor of the thinking of some of the people who work for the Cato Institute and put out policy papers for the Cato Institute. The last time you and I talked, we talked about the Koch brothers. Now, you had a, as I recall, you had a more favorable impression of the Koch brothers than I had. Some of, especially after I believe David Koch wrote that piece in the Wall Street Journal, I wondered really what he was talking about. But anyway, suffice to say, you have a more favorable impression of the Koch brothers than I do, and perhaps some others do. Am I giving your position correctly? Is this the way you feel?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. One minor correction: the Charles Koch. There are actually four Koch brothers, but the two that are kind of active in supporting libertarian ideas are Charles and David. And Charles is the one who wrote the Wall Street Journal piece. But it was a nice piece that I think we talked about briefly last time.
Yeah, yeah.
And the two brothers have been enormously supportive of libertarian ideas, of ideas of freedom. They're not Republican hacks in any way. In fact, they're out there supporting positions that the Republican Party won't take, gay marriage, drug legalization, and that sort of thing. But in the last few years, they have become a bit more involved in partisan politics, and their vehicle of choice is the Republican Party. And so I think they take a lot of flack for that reason, and for the most part, not really deservingly so. They get a really bum rap, and they've done great work not only in supporting ideas, but in supporting college students, and supporting graduate students, and supporting faculty, and supporting the arts, and supporting all sorts of charities, and not to mention the fact that they're very successful businessmen who have created great value for consumers.
And I would just like to point out here, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not saying that the Koch brothers or any conservative or liberal group are doing anything wrong by spending their money and advocating on principles and beliefs that they believe in. I mean, come on. no right-thinking American, and that's a coded phrase, I guess, to some, but I'm going to say it again. No right-thinking American would believe that standing up for what you believe in and spending your money to back it up, that there's something wrong with that. And I really think that is integral and it is a moral absolute when it comes to the American character that you should be able to say as you wish and advocate and as you wish for something you believe in. And so no one's saying the Koch brothers or anyone else is doing anything wrong. I may have mentioned this to you the last time around, Dean. There's a little bit of ideological history with me going on here. The Koch brothers' father was Fred Koch, and he was one of the founders not only of Koch Industries, but of the John Birch Society. Now, I have always been a follower, if you will, of William F. Buckley. As a matter of fact, many times on this program, I've mentioned to the listening audience that I've tried to pattern this program after William F. Buckley's The Firing Line that was on PBS for several years. And Buckley believed in an objective truth. He believed he had a very sentimental and emotional attachment to the idea of the United States of America. Buckley, boy, you want to talk about a no-frills program. He would sit with two chairs in front of him. One would be a liberal, one would be a conservative, and he would let them argue and fight it out and let the chips fall where they may. He wasn't interested in a subjective truth. Buckley believed in an objective truth. Now, having said that, the John Birch Society was something else entirely. They were a much more conservative group that Buckley pushed back against quite a bit. He thought that the Birch Society, again, with that Fred Koch, we're going back in time now here, Dean, that they were so conservative that they may have violated Buckley's view of what the United States was all about. But you would have more information, more experience as far as the Koch brothers are concerned, because aren't the Koch brothers contributors to the Cato Institute where you used to work?
Oh, sure. And as a matter of fact, Charles Koch was one of the founders of the Cato Institute. He co-founded it with Ed Crane and an economist named Murray Rothbard, who's since deceased, back in the mid-70s. So he's been there from the beginning, and they were major funders of the Cato Institute, especially in the early years. In more recent times, they've dropped off in their support, certainly percentage-wise. And as Cato has grown and you know, attracted other donors, they've redirected some of their resources other ways. But yeah, they've been big supporters of the Cato Institute over the years, and big supporters of libertarian ideas in general.
Murray Rothbard, I also thought had some great ideas, and I thought he was a deep thinker. I really did. Anarchist is a bad word in the United States. It was turned into a bad word over 100 years ago. But anarchism really, in Europe, in the later part of the 19th century, was a legitimate political philosophy. The anarchists believed that human beings, by their nature, were good, which is kind of in opposition to what Christians and Jews, in most religious people believe. The anarchists didn't believe that humankind or mankind was in need of salvation. Therefore, we weren't in need of government. Which, right. In my youth, I flirted with that as well. I don't think Murray Rothbard ever got over there, but he was kind of leaning that way a couple of times.
Oh, sure, absolutely. I think most people would consider him an anarcho-capitalist or something along those lines. And the idea is that we can have a voluntary relations between individuals to provide basically everything we need, and so the need for government is questionable to many of us. And so now, going from where we are now to a stateless society is the challenge, and that's no easy hurdle. And as far I have a very pessimistic view of that ever happening, of course, but I think we can make incremental change in that direction and enhance our freedoms, and or at least try to slow the decline in our freedoms. Unfortunately, it's at least a modest goal we could have.
I want to tell you again, and those who listen regularly have heard me say this 10,000 times, we are not free people. We are not a free people. There are too many regulations, too many laws, too many speech codes, too many thought codes, frankly. It's like we live in Oceania, the nightmare world of George Orwell. It is the freedom is an illusion in the United States of America. And I'm sorry to be Donnie Downer, but that's just the way it is. Professor Dean Stanzel of Florida Gulf Coast University is our guest. What is Keynesian economics?
Keynesian economics is named after a man named John Maynard Keynes. He was a British economist in the 20s and 30s who wrote basically the founding work for macroeconomics. Prior to Keynes, there really wasn't macroeconomics and microeconomics. There was just economics, and it was micro-based on the individual level and how individuals choose to use their resources and how businesses choose to seek to maximize profit and that sort of thing. So he's basically the founder of macroeconomics, and it's all gone downhill since then, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, he is still criticized to this day. Now, there are those like the famous New York Times columnist and Princeton economics professor Paul Krugman, who believed that John Maynard Keynes. I can never pronounce the guy's last name. It must be some psychological.
You got it right there, Keynes.
Keynes, yeah. Paul Krugman and others, notably liberals, believe that he is just a brilliant man. But we are here to discuss that and point out these things. And if it inspires you to think or do research, that's a good thing.
In the interest of full disclosure, but before we switch topics here, I do want to point out that I have indeed been one of the many, many beneficiaries of the Koch brothers' contributions to civil society and to academia as a student, as a faculty member. And so we just want to, in the interest of full disclosure, I'm a big fan of theirs, but I've also been the beneficiary of that.
You know, and that influences your thinking, and thank you for pointing that out. I mean, that's legitimate and relevant. And, you know, as with most people, and the Kochs aren't people who come out in front of the television cameras and defend themselves. They're not on the talk shows. They're not on the radio or television talk shows. So that is a conscious decision made, I'm assuming, in part to protect their privacy. But when you do that, it allows your opponents to kind of cast you as they wish you to be seen. You know, if they wish you to be seen as a couple of grumpy, greedy old white men, and you don't send people out to counter that idea, I'm afraid that takes hold. And, of course, I never believed that in the first place. I've seen pictures of the Koch brothers years ago playing basketball. I mean, they're just ordinary guys who are very talented at what they do, and they have their own belief system, which, of course, if we ever get to a place in the United States where that's not allowed, I hope I'm dead by that time. But anyway,
absolutely.
Dr. Dean Stanzel is our guest. Is Tax Freedom Day worth anything, or is that just another political stunt?
No. In fact, that's what I was hoping we'd get to here. Nice segue from, you were talking about freedom a minute ago. One of the, it was actually a businessman in Florida back in the 40s, came up with this idea of trying to put the burden of government in perspective. And so he came up with this idea of Tax Freedom Day. Later, of course, you know, he got old and passed it on to a group called the Tax Foundation, which is basically a think tank in D.C. They're a free market type group that focuses primarily on taxes, though. But so what they do is they take the Tax Freedom Day was the 21st, just a couple days ago, and that's the day when the nation as a whole has earned enough income to pay all of its taxes for the year. So they take the total dollar value of federal, state, and local taxes and just divide that by total income. This year, it's going to be 30.2% of income. So then they say, well, they multiply that by 365 days, and they get 111 days. So April 21st was 111 days into the year, and on that day, on average, you've earned enough to pay your taxes, and now you can start keeping the money for your own things.
You know, that's incredible. It's one of those things that I've known for many, 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 many years. It used to be roughly May 1st, you know, which we're practically there. And I remember as a very young man when I had my very first job, we would kind of meet in this little place. It was an American Legion Hall, actually. And there were a lot of us who were veterans at the time. And we would meet at this place. And every year when May 1st rolled around, because it was also May Day, we would describe it as Tax Freedom Day because that was the day we actually got to spend our own money. And it was infuriating to us then, and it was, and it's infuriating to us now that we would go through winter and spring and arrive at a time where we have paid our taxes, that every dime that we made up to that point went to the government of some kind.
That's right, and it's getting worse. So it's 3 days later than it was last year. It's 11 days later than it was in 2009 when President Obama took office. And the fact is that if you include borrowing, which, you know, federal borrowing, deficit spending, that's going to have to be repaid with taxes later. If you include that, Tax Freedom Day is actually May 6th, 15 days later. So we haven't gotten to that one yet. Americans spend more on taxes than they do on food, clothing, and housing combined. They pay about $4.5 trillion in taxes, $3 trillion at the federal level, and $1.5 trillion at the state and local, compared to about $4.2 trillion for food, clothing, and housing. So it's a lot of money, and it's a big burden on society, on individuals, on individual freedom, right? It really limits what individuals can do with their resources they've earned.
I'm going to disappoint my listeners once again because they want me to say, well, it's all about food stamps, Dean. No, let's see. It's all about, but I'm not going to do that because I have on the air here literally condemned Barack Obama for not being more active in the Middle East, for watching that horrible slaughter that's going on in Syria, just for an example. And other, well, as far as I'm concerned, and what others believe is that American foreign policy is just collapsing. However, one of the biggest drains, if you will, well, I don't want to put it that way. One of the biggest expenses we have as taxpayers is the military. And one of the reasons that our military budget is so large is because Europe, primarily, has depended on us for years to defend them, and we have. They have prospered by not spending money on their own defense. It's infuriating, Dean. I don't know the answer. Can you? What would you do? Everybody has an opinion. We might as well have yours.
Sure. So, I mean, I think that you're right that military spending is a big part of the budget. It's not the biggest part, but it's up there. And I think that we ought to focus on the concept of national defense in terms of defending our country from external attack and get away from some of the, to use a sports metaphor, some of the offense stuff that we do, going overseas and bombing foreign countries and establishing bases in other countries to help defend those sovereign nations. I think we do too much of that, and it puts our young men and women in harm's way unnecessarily, in my view.
It absolutely does, and it's a huge expense. However, if we don't do it, if we don't do it, who's going to do it? And we are, as a capitalist nation that values individual liberty, and we still do, I think, for the most part, value individual liberty. We're a target. I don't know the answer to everything. I guess that goes without saying, Dean, but yeah.
Well, you know, there's a lot of room for reductions in spending, and that's certainly one of them, there's no doubt, but there's a lot of areas where we waste money, and we really need to get back to first principles and ask our politicians ought to be asking themselves this question: is this particular program something that government should be doing? Is this something that the private sector could do better? They ought to ask that about every damn program in the budget, but they're not doing that. And so we've got just this creep, gradual increase of programs that get into the budget and never make their way out of it. And it's a mess, and that's why we've got such huge deficits, such huge debts, and such an impending burden on future generations because of our unwillingness to have some self-discipline and get rid of wasteful programs that we don't need.
And we have a representative form of government which guarantees our freedom, or at least a certain level of freedom. Of course, when you have representative government, you have people that want to keep their jobs. So we have things like the National Railroad Museum in Pennsylvania, which was a complete boondoggle that a longtime congressman got put in his district, the Bridge to Nowhere up in Alaska. I mean, look up Representative Ted Stevens, who was a Republican, by the way. And he started out as a lawyer in the Eisenhower administration. It was because of him, really, that we have the state of Alaska at all. And he brought so many things to Alaska that were not needed and are not needed. But he did it because he believed in Alaskan statehood and to keep himself reelected. I mean, and that story can be repeated time and time and time again. So it gets a little frustrating. It's just not as easy as cutting food stamps. That's the easy thing to do. These people are bums, and I'm as appalled by generational welfare as anybody. But it's just not as easy as cutting food stamps.
It's not. And look, that wouldn't be at the top of my list for things to cut, but certainly I don't think it's a legitimate use of taxpayer funds. I think we have a moral obligation to help those in need, but I don't think we should do it at the point of a gun and force people to do it. Not everyone agrees. And then, you know, I give to charity, and I think others should too, and I think we should help out where we can, especially in the local community where we can see the needs more closely and understand what they are rather than funneling the money through bureaucrats in Washington and having them try to figure out what to do with it.
And then we have to pay them as well. You know, I've heard before that if we gave the welfare budget to the poor, we'd wipe out poverty because there's so much money spent on administrating every dime that goes into the welfare budget. I would hate to even know how that... I used to know, Dean, how much it costs to administer the welfare programs. Are you going to tell me now?
Yeah, there's a statistic on this, and I may get it slightly wrong in terms of the details. I know the number is something around 80,000. If we took the poorest 20% of the population and then just, you know, split the welfare spending among them, they would each have an income of $80,000 a year. Now, obviously, that wouldn't work because then everyone would want to be poor. And so it would change incentives in a way we don't want to, but it puts into perspective, I think, how much money we spend on that type of program. And I think there's no question that there are some who are abusing it, who aren't necessarily in need. There are lots that are in need, so don't get me wrong. But I think, you know, there's ways we can do it that would better help the ones who really need the help. And there's really no incentive for government to figure out a better way.
Wow. You know, it does seem to be quite a task sometimes. This is something that's built off up over many, many decades, over generations. I'm not talking about welfare. I'm talking about the idea of spending. And that's what we're talking about, the idea of spending to accomplish this, that, or the other thing. Well, here's a problem. Let's throw money at it. It drives you completely crazy. It really does. Before we get away from Tax Freedom Day, is there any other observations that you'd like to make?
Yeah, let me throw out, just for your listeners there, the Iowa, so they break this down by states as well, so they look at the total and they break it down by states. In Iowa, the Tax Freedom Day was April 13th, which ranks you tied for 32nd, meaning 32nd lowest, where first is the lowest taxes and 50th would be the highest, so these are about middle of the pack, a little below that.
Sure. Who's in first place?
Right here. First place is, oh, that's worse. Hold on, I'm looking at it the wrong way around. First place is Louisiana. I was going to say Connecticut. I knew that one right. Louisiana, and then followed by Mississippi and South Dakota.
Yeah, I'm sure of that. I'm sure of that. I am pleased to talk with you about the Koch brothers. I really am. To bring a little perspective to, I would like, if nothing else, for us to consider that the Koch brothers are human beings like everybody else, and they are very successful. And they have every right to advocate. They are not evil people because they are advocating in this way. Don't get swept up in the talk radio thing or the talk television thing. It sounds funny coming from me, I know. But don't let yourself be emotionally manipulated. It's not a good thing. Investigate these things and learn. The hallmark of an individual who is a free person is a person who can think. So don't let yourself be led by emotional pitches from any side. Do your own research, educate yourself, and make up your own mind. It's at the heart and soul of freedom, as far as I'm concerned. Dr. Stanzel, is there anything in closing?
No, I think you nailed it there. You know, we as people need to pay attention and be a little more, a little less complacent and be a little more active to help restrain the growth of freedom. I'm sorry, restrain the limitations on our freedom that keep growing.
Dean Stanzel has been our guest. Dr. Dean Stanzel with Florida Gulf Coast University. Thank you so much, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
AM 1400 KVFD, the voice of Fort Dodge.